Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome back our guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther, professor of family medicine at the University of North Carolina, who's been a frequent guest co-host while Dr. Christy Page has been on sabbatical. Welcome, Dr. Gwyther.
Thank you.
It's really great to have you back again. You're looking good, I must say.
Thank you, sir.
For all our listeners out there. Well, you know, on our show today, Bob, we're going to be talking with Dr. Eric Topol, cardiologist, author, and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute, about precision medicine and how it can be facilitated by, as he says, the medicalization of the smartphone. I'm really looking forward to this, and this is one of the world's experts on this topic.
Yeah, he's got an impressive record of publication and invention and quality.
But even more importantly, he's got a vision of what we can be doing in technology, which is an important one for both providers and patients. But first, we've got some interesting research that matters. And let's just dive right in. This first article about mental stress, young women, and heart disease. How do they link these three topics?
Well, women, we know, have worse outcomes from MIs.
Myocardial
infarctions, heart attacks. We used to think because their coronary arteries are a little bit smaller, but it's probably more complex than that. So what these people did is to say that people who have stress can have decreased cardiac output, and they wanted to measure whether women had it more often than men.
And in particular, if young women have it more often than younger men, which I found very interesting, hypothesizing that these younger women are at even higher stress due to all of the responsibilities they have in addition to the same health concerns.
So they designed a study where they took 686 patients, of whom 191 were female, between the ages of 34 and 79, and they broke them into under 50 and then over 60, I think, and actually gave people some stressful things and had imaging at the same time of their heart. And they found, not very surprisingly to a lot of people, that the younger women had more difficulty with dropped blood pressure and reduced blood flow than the older women or the men.
Yeah, I found this really fascinating and important data. 33% of the women aged 50 years or younger had this reduction in blood flow when presented with just a mental challenge in an exercise, compared to 8% of the men. And this seemed to decrease the older the women got. So by the time they were older, there was very little difference. But I think that this is important data for all of our listeners out there, particularly younger women, spouses, partners, friends of these women, that we should be reducing stress. We should recognize that there could be silent problems associated with heart for high stress, particularly for younger women.
And Dr. Vaccarino, the study lead author, actually considered the fact that there's a lot of young women who have a lot of stress in their life. They're trying to do a job. They have a family to raise. And the question is, what can you do about that? And the answer is, maybe it would be helpful to find a way to relax and just take a little load off every day, and that could be useful.
Our next research is on actually the potential association between extra weight during what they call the Great Recession of 2008. I don't know. I never really had heard that term, the Great Recession of 2008, but that's what they term it.
So that is the greatest recession we've had in the history of our country, and it started in 2008. And this group from California had access to data from the California school system of height and weight on kids in the 5th, 7th, and 9th grades. And they also could tap the Bureau of Labor Statistics and see how unemployment happened in the families of these children.
And they basically found that as the recession was beginning, 28% of the children in the public schools were overweight. And this increased to 40% in 2009. And you know, this isn't cause and effect. Very difficult to say that one thing caused the other. And then they try to hypothesize that maybe it's due to lots of different factors, including less access to parks, more physical inactivity, cut back in schools. I don't know to what extent all of those things could be operative, but it does hypothesize some things we should be aware of.
And since obesity, which is the thing that stuck out, is so intimately linked to diet, they were hypothesizing that because they didn't have as much cash in their pockets on average. They were buying cheaper food, largely starchy, that sort of thing that tends to put on weight. Now, they didn't come out and say that, but that was the supposition.
Yeah, this was actually published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. We would welcome your thoughts on this and what this might mean. Sometimes you see these studies of association in public health or population health, and I think sometimes we struggle to understand it. We think it's important, though I think one can have different interpretations. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, which is sitting in a traffic jam unhealthy? I mean, before I see any of this research, Bob, do you like sitting in a traffic jam?
Nobody likes sitting in a traffic jam. And I want to add that this was done at the University of Surrey in England, and I don't know that their pollution problems are any worse than ours. But they found that the pollution level inside of automobiles that were sitting in traffic jams were 40% higher than they were when they were in ordinary traffic.
I was not too long ago in Atlanta, and I don't know if you've been in Atlanta, Bob, but I would say that it took me about an hour and 15 minutes to go 1 mile.
Yeah, and that's really frustrating.
And 5 o'clock on near Peachtree Street, just trying to get actually to the subway to catch a plane. And I thought, oh my goodness, what if I were doing this every day? And I do know friends that travel hour and a half each way every day. And what this suggests, though, is that sitting in those traffic jams could actually be bad for your health, not just because you might get angry or whatever, but because you're actually maybe exposed to higher levels of pollution from idling vehicles.
Well, the authors point out that in London, it's estimated that there's 3.7 premature deaths in the year 2012 caused by this pollution and its effect on health.
And what they suggest is that if you close the car windows and switch off the fan, of course, that would give you the lowest exposure to pollutants. I think in the middle of the summer, you might also have heat stroke. But it also says that if you can recirculate the air within the car during these period of times, that may be helpful. If you can maybe not go right up on top of the car in front of you, so there's a little dissipation of whatever the exhaust fumes coming from you. These are some practical ideas.
They really are. And apparently, they say that the effects of polluted air kill more people than traffic accidents on the highways in England, which is impressive.
Well, again, some things we might be able to do. Let's talk about our last research that matters, Bob, and see what your thoughts are about this. This is a study that looks at, does it matter when a patient is operated on, if they're operated on in the morning, the late afternoon, or the evening? And I've always said intrinsically, try to be the first case in the morning. That just to me as a doctor always seemed intuitive. I don't know what advice you would give to patients early before you read this article.
Well, for one thing, there's more people there. Rooms, operating rooms are open. They're expecting people of the appointments and they don't have the shock of gunshot wounds and that sort of thing rolling in. But they did find, in fact, that there was a higher rate of death among the late day patients, evening patients, and then also they got higher even as a percentage in the wee hours of the morning.
Yeah, and this was research that was done by some colleagues up north in Canada, and it, you know, suggesting that there was a, you know, a 2 times higher rate of actually dying if you were operated on in the evening and there was somewhat intermediate in the late afternoon, and the lowest rate was in the morning, which some people can't help. You know, if you get an accident, you come in, you need surgery, and it's in the evening, you're going to get operated on the evening. But I do think this suggests we need to look at this further. I mean, if I have a choice between when I'm going to have my operation, I'm going to choose to have it earlier in the day when people are fresh, between when they're not tired and when I'm not tired.
And this study was done by a bunch of anesthesiologists, and they point out that there's people that are tired that are dragged in at 2 a.m. on call and all that sort of thing. So it's a more difficult situation at night for sure.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Bob. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Eric Topol, cardiologist, author, director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute, one of the renowned scientists in the world, about precision medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Dr. Eric Topol, cardiologist, author, and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute, about precision medicine and how it can be facilitated by, as he says, the medicalization of the smartphone. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Topol.
Thanks very much.
You know, to start with, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in a career and being really one of the experts in the world on this area of translation and digitalization?
Well, you know, back in 99, so that's 17 years ago or so, I started seeing this technology of doing an electrocardiogram, since I'm a cardiologist, over the internet. Say, whoa, that would be a whole big step towards remote entry of data and using the web in a whole different way. I didn't really push on that, but then 10 years ago, moved to San Diego, which you may know is the home of the capital of wireless technology. And soon after arriving here, I actually was at a smartphone conference, and they were talking about smartphone camera, and I started thinking, wait, there's so many things you could do with this. And one of the most extraordinary things is capturing data from an individual in their real world. And that's what opened up the whole idea of why don't we really seize this opportunity, since people so much rely on their smartphone for their day-to-day life. How about for their health, too?
For our listeners, before we get going too far into this, could you please tell them what you mean by translational science and precision medicine?
Yeah, I'm much more into the term individualized medicine, but basically precision medicine has been adopted by the government now in the U.S. Basically, they both mean the fact that we can take medicine to a new level with data about an individual, such as the DNA interactions with drugs they may take, or screening a value for particular conditions or treatments, whatever the diagnosis. When you have granular data about an individual, you can deliver much more precise prevention and treatment. And what I like the term individual, it has this double entendre, which is that individualized medicine means the individual is driving their care much more, which is what I would like to foster, because patients are going to be generating their data, and with the help of algorithms, they're going to be getting a lot more power out of their data than ever before, and it exemplifies this shift. So the translational part means just taking data that has previously been unobtainable in many respects and changing the future of medicine and the future of an individual's whole healthcare.
You know, you wrote a recent editorial in The Lancet, and we were really fascinated by it, where you really talk about this digitalized medicine, this coming together, perhaps, of these two things that you've just discussed, and say that it can really empower both patients and providers. Tell us how you see that happening, because I think for a lot of listeners, maybe a lot of doctors, we see things like digitalized electronic medical records and we think, oh, this actually, it does help, but it also comes between patients and providers. How do you see it helping?
Well, I think providers, doctors, healthcare professionals have a couple of reasons why they'd want to embrace this new era. One is that they're overwhelmed. That's, of course, led to burnout and not enough time with patients and all sorts of things that are really negative hits. So shifting some of that burden of obtaining data and interpreting it to the patients who are willing is going to decompress things. But moreover, when a doctor has a lot more granular, rich data about an individual and can make better recommendations about what is the right screening test or treatment or, you know, whatever that would normally be the case in providing oversight of a patient's care and data, that is a whole new day, because I think we have a serious problem. It's been documented regarding misdiagnosis and medical errors and all this inefficient care that we have today, where we can rev this up just by having data that was previously not incorporated when we evaluated each individual, each patient. So this is why it really works well for both groups, and it's not just the patients and not just the doctors.
Can you give us an example, maybe from your own field of expertise, where you see this happening and where you see the potential?
Well, there's so many examples I could give, but one that is a recurrent example is blood pressure. So as a cardiologist, I get a lot of people who have pretty severe, somewhat refractory blood pressure to manage. And what's interesting is when these people who previously couldn't manage their blood pressure now have a smartphone with a blood pressure connect, whether that's a wristband without a cable or even if it's an arm cuff. But all their blood pressure measurements are going directly to their phone and it's being graphed. And they can tell when their blood pressure is out of whack from the preset ranges, the desired ranges. They have the contextual advantage that, oh, well, this is occurring when the medicine's wearing off in the evening or because they went back to work on Monday or they had an argument with their spouse. I could never do that with a one-off type measurement when, you know, they come to see me, or the old days of when people would do occasional measurements and write them down. I've seen tremendous progress in people managing their own blood pressure by having a lot more frequent measurement, by having it data visualized on one screen, all the summary of their data, and the context that they previously didn't have. And this is going to actually shift to an even more exciting capability where they won't have to press start, that it would just happen continuously. And when that is the case, then we'll have a whole new window into blood pressure, such as during sleep or traffic or, you know, any emotional upset, where it's the most unlikely time where somebody might actually think of taking their blood pressure. So that's just one example of the most common chronic condition of man, but it cuts through almost every diagnosis you can think of.
We got some stuff to prepare today for this interview, and I was very impressed to see that the government really is also behind what you're trying to do, just because it's interested in doing the right thing, not all kinds of things that may not be necessary, and this could certainly help that. I've been around long enough, though, to see that innovation breeds new kinds of charges. And are you concerned at all that gathering this granular data is going to break the bank, which seems like it's pretty well broken already?
Yeah, it's already broken, I'm afraid. We're over the $3 trillion mark. At least a trillion of that is waste. I think a very good portion of that waste is the imprecision of medicine. The fact that of the top 20 drugs in gross sales, only at best 30% of people respond to those medications is an example of how imprecise things are today. So, no, most of the things we're talking about are with cheap chips that is really leveraging Moore's Law, that are even at consumer-level pricing below $100. They're basically piggybacking on smartphones, which over 80% of American adults have. So we're talking about low-cost, whole new sources of data, a patient being much more in charge and shifting the power and the sense of higher sense of well-being and responsibility that comes with that. So I think that's why the government is behind this, because it's clearly a way to reduce care costs. One great example is the surge in telemedicine, where people can connect instantly with a doctor through their phone instead of the average in the United States of 2.6 weeks. And at the same cost as a copay through their employer health plan. So the government's behind that as well as most employers. So we're seeing lots of things that are leveraging really this extraordinary digital technology.
Well, I know we're going to want to hear a little bit more about your thoughts about this digital technology, some more examples, also potentially talk about some of the concerns that may exist, and also hear about your recent very large grant from the NIH, National Institute of Health, in this effort. But we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Eric Topol, cardiologist, author, and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute, about precision medicine and how it can be facilitated by the digital world. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wyther. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wyther. We've been talking with Dr. Eric Topol, cardiologist, author, and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute, about precision medicine and how it can be facilitated by the digital world. And right before the break, Dr. Topol, we were about to actually ask you about that. You've just received a very large NIH grant as part of a new effort to further the study of precision medicine. Tell us about the grant and the type of research that you're pursuing.
Yeah, well, today, actually, that grant that initially was announced at $120 million was increased to $205 million. So it's a big, large grant, certainly the largest one I've ever been involved with. This is about the Precision Medicine Initiative. This was announced back in 2015 by President Obama in the State of the Union Address. And it's everything that we've been talking about today, that is new efforts to enroll 1 million volunteers in the United States, a real cross-section of Americans, to evaluate over the long term, like the Framingham study, whether it's genome sequencing, microbiome sensors, environmental sensors, not just wearable sensors. So all sorts of new technology that will make medicine more precise and more individualized. And so we're heading up the participant-facing technologies, the so-called Participant Technology Center, as well as directly responsible for recruiting 350,000 Americans. So we're really excited about that, and it fits in really well with the theme that we've had for many years, which is this whole approach of changing, individualizing medicine.
And how will you know if it's working? What's the outcome that you'll know that this was a great investment by the government in work that sounds like it could be transformational?
Well, there's many ways that you could say it's working. So that, for example, if people are having a outcome that is happening faster, like an accurate diagnosis, for example, at less expense through a smartphone app, not even having to see a doctor or just seeing a doctor to confirm things, and basically the whole cheaper, faster, better is going to be one way that we've already seen that before this big NIH program gets initiated in enrollment of the 1 million Americans. But we should be able to see that replicated at scale. But there's many other ways that we'll be evaluating that, the sense of well-being and the shift of information and with that power to patients. Remember, too, that it's not for everyone. It's for those people who want to take more responsibility and want to have their data coming right back to them, which is what's unique about this PMI, this Precision Medicine Initiative, is that all the data that are generated by individual will be coming directly back to them. That's not really been done so much before. So this is a new era of really getting away from medical paternalism, which has been ingrained for over two millennia. And, you know, really the blockbuster of the future, my colleague Leonard Kish came up with, is the patient, and we're giving the patient that opportunity.
So that sort of feeds right into a question I have about this. So I've been around a pretty long time in medicine and seen an awful lot of people coming in with their searches off the web or their input from Aunt Sally or somebody to say what you've got is really a problem. And I can see in the design of what you're doing with this precision management, that you're going to put data right out there for patients to see first, sounds like to me. And are you anticipating any difficulties with frightening diagnoses like diabetes or cancer or something, or that people get really completely backwards on what is going on because of their ideas, not yours?
Yeah, well, you're bringing up a critical point. First of all, let me be clear that the attitude towards most physicians has been patients can't handle the truth. You know, the famous Jack Nicholson
line. Yeah, right.
That has been a bias. And too many studies now have overridden that concern. Studies that people handle their genomic data well and all their medical data. You're bringing up, though, potential exceptions whereby a new diagnosis of cancer, unsuspected, you know, should that come to the patient first through some type of, you know, app or text or their smartphone, or would that be much better communicated through a doctor? So clearly there are certain sensitive things where, you know, the human touch and the importance of how that is presented by a physician are going to be paramount. But for most things, and we're talking about already documented, genomic data and sensor data, things like their blood pressure, electrocardiogram, sleep study results that they can do themselves in their own bedroom, and on and on and on. Patients can do exceptionally well as long as they're willing. I mean, this is not for everyone. This is an opt-in story. But we have to get over this thing about that patients are going to have terrible anxiety by having their data and that they're going to, go cuckoo because it's completely off base. And so we'll see that in this PMI program that we've been talking about, but I've already seen it. And I think we need more physicians and healthcare professionals to understand that patients can indeed handle the truth.
We're talking with Dr. Eric Topol, author and director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute. And Dr. Topol, let me ask you about, with this really massive expansion of data, even if it works as promised, which would be amazing in many ways, and your vision is very optimistic, talk to us about privacy concerns, because we see, 500 million data breaches with major companies and the next one's waiting to be had. What are the concerns? Because it almost certainly will happen.
Yeah, well, that is my principal concern, that privacy and security is there's not enough being done about that. And now we're talking about precious data, precious information about an individual. They don't really want to have all their diagnoses and drug treatments and whatnot put out on the web. So there are ways that we can deal with this that are, first of all, we have no government action regarding the hacking, the hospital systems that are being held hostage, in fact, having all the patient's data being hacked and held ransom. I mean, things that are happening on almost a daily basis. You referred to the Yahoo. That's not medical data, but 500 million people. It's unbelievable, right? So we have to have technological solutions, which there are out there, like, for example, blockchain. We have to get rid of having aggregation of millions of people's data on servers, but rather get it down to the units of one or a family, which is what a blockchain entity, a peer-to-peer ledger can achieve. But we also have to have legislation because we have nothing that's being done to take this on. And this whole concept that privacy is dead is not going to work in a digital medical era where it only can move forward if privacy is assured. It can never be 100% guaranteed, but we have to come as close as possible to that goal.
In this million patients that you intend to enroll, so let's say they sign up for you, they get hooked up to various things and they got a lot of data coming in. Are they then patients of Scripps, or how about the doctor?
No. They're throughout the United States. They're representing every type of condition, health and disease. I mean, of course, ancestry, gender, socioeconomic class, geography. So no, this will be throughout the entire United States, and we are going to do everything we can to come up with as close a representative cross-section as possible.
We appreciate your time, and we know that you have an amazing social media presence, an incredible following. You are one of the most published, prolific scientists in the world. And I wonder, you must have some tips that you put out over social media or that you can share with our listeners about what they can do to incorporate the philosophy of precision medicine into their current healthcare. What can they do?
Well, you're very kind, very appreciative. I think what first thing is to start being comfortable with giving patients who are eager to take more responsibility. I encourage them to, if they have conditions that are easily monitored by themselves, like blood pressure, heart rhythm, and sleep apnea, and glucose for diabetes, and so many more, to get more, get patients more into this, to nurture that. And for them to be the engagement, which that term doesn't even take it to where we want it to go. We want it to be a liberation, emancipation from having to have everything done through appointments that are hard to come by and that are very brief and involve lots of inconvenience and long waiting. We have technology now that is going to supplement the old way of practicing medicine and hopefully getting physicians to embrace that for the right patients would be terrific.
Well, we certainly appreciate you being the right guest for our show today, because I can't think of anyone better who has a message that both patients and providers need to hear and pay attention to. Thank you so much, Dr. Eric Topol, for being our guest today on Your Health.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we will be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health for House Call segment today. We'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about anesthesia.
Every time I'm given anesthesia, it seems like it takes days for the effects to completely wear off. I'm going in next week for a minor procedure that requires anesthesia. Is there anything I can do to mitigate the effects?
Well, that's a very common problem, and a lot of people have it. It depends somewhat on the recipe of general anesthetic drugs that you get. So I'd say, first of all, if this is such a minor procedure, can it be done under local anesthetic or regional anesthetic so you don't have to have the IV and the stuff in your brain at all? But if I had to have general, you can tell your anesthesiologist that you've had this problem, and he or she can use one of a variety of drugs. Some of them may be less sleep-inducing and drowsy than others.
And it also, you know, Bob, sometimes some of the side effects of the anesthesia are kind of good. You don't want to remember necessarily the fear or maybe some initial pain that could have occurred. So sometimes some of the choices may actually be helpful. So I think part of it depends on what sort of things that you don't want, like if it lasts several days, and that you would want something, a short-acting one, just like you say.
My personal experience has been to be groggy, which is not useful and pleasant, but I can have anesthetics that they use that don't do that too.
Yeah, I think make that appointment before you go in to make the choice, to really talk about the choice, and I like the idea of talking with your family doctor about that. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My husband is allergic to several foods, and I can eat anything. Our son is 6 months old, and we're wondering if we need to take any specific precautions as we start giving him new foods, given my husband's allergies.
Well, this is a really good question, and it raises, I think, my first thought is, well, what is the likelihood if I've got a parent or two parents that have allergies that my child's going to have allergies? I think some of us might think, oh, well, that's natural, but we know that allergies are really common. 10, 20, 30% might have allergies clearly to something. So it wouldn't be surprised that the child has some allergies. The question is, what would really cause you to be really concerned? Are there some things that would have you really concerned, Bob?
Yeah, if you had a child with eczema already, I think I'd be wary. If you have a family history with two or three or more people who've had allergy problems, then that's probably worth talking to your doctor about. But, you know, just one person in the family with allergies doesn't make it very much more risky than none at all.
Yeah, there was a research study, I think, Bob, a couple years ago. I think it was called the Health Nut Study, kind of an ironic name. But there were 5,000 kids, and they really looked at these infants, and they saw, well, what if one family member does have, just as you said, allergies? And it was only a very mild increase in food allergy. It really was if you had two or more immediate family members with pretty severe allergies. And so they really started saying you should really define the risk as having that two or more, like you said, asthma, allergy, eczema, really bad drug side effects. These are the sort of things that perhaps should be a little bit more worried about. It sounds like in this particular case, the worry's not so great.
Right. And I think it's a good idea to talk to the physician if you're really concerned about it, though.
Yeah. Laura, what's our very next house call?
As the days have been getting shorter, I've begun to wonder if I might have seasonal affective disorder. What should I watch out for, and how do you treat it if you do have it?
Well, most SADS, so-called seasonal affective disorder syndrome, is probably depression. And so you'd be looking out for the classic signs of decreased mood, low energy, sadness, crying. And if that's starting to resurrect itself, it's probably worth talking to your doc about it. And if you have it, typically what they treat it with is one of two things. Some meds are pretty good for it and don't have so many side effects. Bupropion comes to mind for that. Or you can get various kinds of bright light producing devices that you can set up in the morning and do your work in front of the light so it's shining into your eyes, but you're not looking at it. Or they have visors that they incorporate these lights into that you can just go about your morning. And it turns out you don't have to get up in the dark and do it. You can do the extra photon collection while it's already sunny out.
Yeah, you know, I've noticed, Bob, that as the days seem to have already gotten a little bit shorter, that it's like, oh, that's not so good. You know, and I it's getting darker a little soon. And I think many of us recognize that there's a change that that light does in that biological rhythm, because am I going to get tired a little bit sooner? It's a little grayer, a little colder. You know, a lot of things that go into this. And I do think that understanding the difference between just kind of like a natural change as the light gets shorter versus I'm actually feeling kind of depressed now. I'm feeling down and in the mood, and I have less desire to eat, and really affecting your life like depression does. I think those are really good things to understand. And the other thing to understand, that seasonal affective disorder is treatable.
No, there are things you can do. And the lights, you know, are not medications, and it hopefully isn't going to affect you in any way except to decrease the symptoms of SADS.
Yeah, there's actually a seasonal pattern assessment questionnaire, and we can actually ask our health science librarians to put that up on our website. People could see this. Doctors don't usually actually kind of ask about this, but I do also think doctors aren't aware of this enough as a problem. So I encourage us to think more about it, and we really appreciate our listeners' house call. Instead of our last house call, I just wanted to direct a question to our great executive producer, Laura. You know, we had on the show today, Laura, and I'm sure you were hearing with great interest our Eric Topol as he talked about precision medicine and the digitalized smartphone. And I've seen you in the studio many times, and you had something that I asked about on the back of your phone. You had some little metal squares on the back of your phone. I thought it was so cool. You had a designer phone, but I wasn't exactly correct, was I?
No, you weren't. I really identified with the segment in your conversation with him today because I actually have, in layman's terms, a really funky heart rhythm. I have PVCs, which stands for,
premature ventricular contractions.
Not the plastic pipings.
Yeah, well, and I feel them. My PVC burden is about 31 to 33%, which means about a third of my beats are these PVCs. So I feel them, and I'm symptomatic. And I was diagnosed with them probably a few years ago. And my electrophysiologist recently, probably within the past couple years, recommended that I get this really cool iPhone case with two metal plates on the back where I can take my EKG. Which has actually really been helpful for me, because before, where I might have, having a jittery heart can cause anxiety if you're not really sure what's going on. But now I can take an EKG and look and see that even though it's a weird rhythm, it's a weird rhythm that I can recognize. And I like having that power as a patient. So I really identified with the patient side of the conversation that you were having today.
So even though it's weird, you're normal.
Yeah, right. It's normal for me. So.
Well, that's really empowering. I think it's very cool. It's exciting to see this. I think as providers, we need to be aware of this more. And as patients, boy, thank you, because that's a really important story.
Yeah, I enjoyed the conversation. I thought it was really important, too.
Well, we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've asked and addressed issues that are important to you. You can send your own questions, send a story to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. I'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my guest co-host again today, Dr. Bob Gwyther, and our guest today, Dr. Eric Topol. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And we look forward to seeing you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.